From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn, and happy Friday, everybody. On today's show, Sony won't make any more Spider-Man movies, along with Disney, which owns Marvel Studios. Can Sony keep its Spidey sense tingling all on its own? Then Ava DuVernay on what drove her to make When They See Us, the Netflix series about the Central Park Five that's up for 16 Emmys.
Everything I did was for the men. I mean, if only five people watched the movie and loved it, and it was those five, and they felt transformed by it, that was truly and honestly my goal every day and was enough.
All that coming up on The Frame. It's Friday, and that's when we check in with our friends at Variety to see what's happening in Hollywood. Matt Donnelly is a senior film writer at Variety. Hey, Matt.
Hi, John. How are you?
I'm good. So I want to talk about a really big show business divorce. We've got two very powerful people, Tom and Kevin, calling it quits. Hundreds of millions of dollars are at stake. There's been a lot of blaming and failed talks. And there's even a custody battle at the center of it. And that kid is Spider-Man. I'm talking about the breakup between Sony and Disney's Marvel Studios. So what is going on?
So Sony Pictures has enjoyed the licensing to Spider-Man for years. And in the events leading up to the final two Avengers films, Disney sort of walked across the aisle and did a licensing pact that would give them access to the character for these massive superhero collaborative movies. But moving forward, you know, I think everyone has different agendas. The Marvel Cinematic Universe is changing dramatically over the next couple of phases. And Sony, I think, feels in a position where they don't want to share any of the glory and especially the revenue with a company as powerful as Disney. So effectively, Kevin Feige will no longer be a supervising producer on any Spider-Man film. And likewise, Spider-Man will not appear in any Marvel film.
Yeah, and the Tom I'm referring to is Tom Rothman, who's the head of Sony Pictures. So I'm going to play a clip from 2002. This is the original Spider-Man movie with Tobey Maguire.
Whatever life holds in store for me, I will never forget these words. With great power comes great responsibility.
This is a movie that was really important, I think, in the development of superheroes in Hollywood. It was a huge hit. It grossed $820 million worldwide, and I think it really set the stage for a lot of what followed. But what happened more recently is, I think it's fair to say, Sony kind of lost their way with this franchise. There was an iteration with Andrew Garfield that was not very successful.
You seriously think I'm a cop? Cop in a skin-tight red and blue suit. You know, you've got a mind of a true scholar, sir.
Spider-Man 2 in 2014 was not well reviewed. So Sony reaches out to Marvel. Marvel comes in and works with Sony on a couple of movies, Spider-Man Homecoming with Tom Holland in 2017 and Spider-Man Far From Home, which comes out this year.
You look really pretty.
Therefore, I have value?
No. No, that's not what I meant at all.
I'm messing with you. Thank you.
You're welcome.
You look pretty too.
Which is the highest grossing Sony movie ever. And the question is, how much does Marvel's involvement have to do with that film's success? What do you think?
I think it's a pretty good point. And, you know, Kevin Feige, who runs Marvel Studios, has always been really open about his adoration for the character. So I think there was a lot of TLC here with Holland in these two films. When you look at the box office, the numbers aren't actually that different. But when you go to critical reception, I would argue that Homecoming and Far From Home are by far the best received films. But yeah, I definitely think that Marvel is a machine that's firing on all cylinders in terms of the process of development, production, and post-production. So I think just sort of folding Spider-Man into that entire sort of universe, he's been given a sort of quality control over Spider-Man that now apparently will not continue.
What's fascinating about Sony's history with Marvel, and this was in Ben Fritz's book, The Big Picture, back in 1998, when Sony was looking for Spider-Man rights, they approached Marvel about getting Spider-Man. And Marvel said, well, what about every character we have, like Thor, Iron Man, everybody? They said you could have it all for $25 million. And Sony said, nobody cares about those other characters. We don't want to do that. And then 11 years later, Disney buys Marvel for $4 billion. One of the best bad deals ever, I think. But Sony, I think, really has its work cut out for it. If it's going to try to make a Spider-Man movie without Marvel, the history is not really on Sony's side, is it?
No, it's not. And if you look at what they've done, you know, they own some other 900 characters that are tangentially related to Spider-Man, and it's part of their licensing deal. You know, look at something like Venom, which is a Tom Hardy film that, while it grossed quite a lot of money, I don't think a lot of people felt was up to the quality of other Marvel films. So yeah, there's a lot of pressure to sort of keep the ethos of Spider-Man as we know him without any guidance from Kevin Feige or his team.
What has the fan reaction been? Because I saw that there was a trending topic on Twitter called #SaveSpiderManFromSony. What are other people saying about this dispute?
I mean, they're devastated. But yeah, there's a petition to storm the studio lot dressed as Spider-Man. and this has provoked a really strong reaction from everybody. You know, even J.C. Lee, who's the daughter of the late Marvel founder Stan Lee, came out in support of the studio of Sony, saying that she believes her father's creations deserve multiple points of view from different filmmakers, and went as far as to say that no one had treated her father worse than Disney executives and Marvel executives during his life.
We've talked about a lot of live-action Spider-Man movies, but a year ago, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, an animated film, was not only a critical hit, but also did pretty well commercially.
Wait. How could there be two Spider-Men? There can't be two Spider-Men. Can there?
I suspect Sony will be doing another Spider-Verse movie, and I'm sure they'll be doing at least one or two more Spider-Man films, right?
Tom Holland and the director of those previous two films are both on the hook for two more. And I think the idea was always to have Holland and Tom Hardy as Venom meet up in the same film, sort of somebody's attempt at their own Avengers-style sort of films. And then, yes, I mean, Spider-Verse was a massive success. You know, it won an Oscar, which is rare for a non-Disney studio in the animated space. And I think especially in terms of representation in that film, you know, you saw Spider-Man cast as everything from, you know, a young man of color, a woman, even an animated pig got to play Spider-Man. So I think that there's, you know, you sort of see how far that IP can stretch. And I think that they'll do everything they can to exploit Spider-Man and his fans around the world.
Matt Donnelly is a senior film writer at Variety. Matt, have a great weekend. And remember, with great power comes great responsibility.
Thank you, John.
Coming up on The Frame, a visit to the creative compound where Ava DuVernay is building her own Hollywood empire. Earlier this week, some of The Frame crew and I piled into my car to visit a new production complex near downtown LA.
Hi. We're here to see Ava.
First and last name, sir.
John Horn.
Okay.
We're all here from KPCC.
Awesome. How's it going?
Good.
I'm cheering right now.
Yeah, thank you.
The place is home base for filmmaker Ava DuVernay. She directed and co-wrote When They See Us. The Netflix series is based on the false convictions of the so-called Central Park Five. It's currently up for 16 Emmys. DuVernay has created a multi-purpose organization called Array. Its compound includes writers' rooms, editing suites, event spaces, and a brand new 50-seat theater, which is where we had our chat.
Well, it's my favorite place in the world. It's I built the place that I couldn't find. You know, a place here in LA that's really has people of color and women in its DNA as a part of its building, not as an inclusion program, not as a diversity initiative, but in everything that we do here, every project, people who are usually uncentered are the epicenter of our work here. And so to have this space, which we just, this actual theater space within the campus, is like a miracle for, you know, a black girl from Compton who loves movies to now own her own, you know, 50-seat stadium-style theater, DCP compliant with Dolby. I mean, come on. It's fantastic.
When I was driving down here, I had a flashback because I used to work right down the street at the Associated Press. And you and I were working in journalism at the same time something happened. And it was very dispiriting for me to witness, and I think it was for you. And that was the O.J. Simpson trial.
Oh, goodness.
And what I saw was a newsroom that stopped covering everything else.
Yeah.
To the exclusion of education, politics, healthcare, you name it. The LA Bureau of the AP only covered the O.J. Simpson trial. And some of the things we did were not that impressive. Some of them were a little tawdry. And I think that was a moment in your professional career where you thought you might be doing one thing and changed your mind and did another. So what did you see in it? How did it make you the person you are today?
It was a turning point personally, but I think it was a real turning point for journalism in general. You know, the resources that are allocated to certain kinds of stories, an imbalance in what was prioritized, and it really triggered this era of sensationalism and kind of, you know, paparazzi-driven, you know, get the story, get the headline, you know, pre-social media, where the prioritization is the self. You know, right before that, it was the prioritization and exotification of the other and the famous person and the VIP and that kind of ferocious appetite that I think the media at the time, all coming from that case, really leaned into in a way that was dispiriting for me as a young journalist. And I'm glad that it hit me so hard as what I did not want to do, that I immediately left and started to try to find other ways to support the kinds of stories I was interested in. And yeah, but that was a crazy, crazy time.
And it was also a time, and I think about this when I think about When They See Us, about how the media shapes a narrative and how that narrative defines the story as opposed to the facts defining the story. And I wonder if you've stepped back and thought about what happened back during the O.J. Simpson trial and how the media kind of assumes a common narrative and how that might have played out in the Central Park case.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the reason those boys went to jail was to prison and jail was because of a story that was really contrived. Contrived is the right word, because if there was actual investigation, if there was actual rigorous news work being done, if, you know, the talking points of the New York PD did not just appear in the New York Times and in the New York papers at the time, if anyone in the realm of journalism who I feel should have been much more responsible with what they were relaying, if anyone had stood up and said, wait, let me take a second look, the boys, I think it would have had a much different outcome. But it was a kind of a deadly stew of law enforcement and people not standing up, political entities not standing up, and these boys and their families kind of went down for it.
When you think about what this series was in service to, or whom it was in service to, how would you define it? What was the ultimate responsibility you felt as a filmmaker, and who was it to?
To the men. Everything I did was for the men. I mean, if only five people watched the movie and loved it, and it was those five, and they felt transformed by it, that was truly and honestly my goal every day and was enough. So on the day that they told me that I did more and better work than they expected, was really the day that the whole thing succeeded for me and it hadn't even come out. And to know that in telling the story, I could change their lives. You know what I mean? I knew that I could change the story around them. I know that I could amplify what really happened. And to actually see, I just talked to Antron yesterday. And he said, sis, I did one of the things you told me to do. I said, what? You tell me I should get out more, you know. You told me a couple of months ago I really need to get a life. So I'm trying. And I said, what'd you do? I got those season tickets to the local sports team where he lives. And because he did nothing but stay in the house, go work out, and come back. He was still in a prison. And he's still very resenting of his father. And so across the board with all of them, two of them have agents now and on speaking tours. I mean, Corey Wise is a literal celebrity on the streets of New York with just people not just praising him, but wanting to share their story with him, being healed by it. I mean, they're all doing incredible things that they were not doing before. Their story was obscured in this kind of haze of ambiguity. There are a lot of people who did not realize that they were ever exonerated. They just thought they got out.
We're talking with Ava DuVernay at her offices near downtown LA. I was watching the series. It was after the first episode. And I said to my wife, this is almost unwatchable. And she said, if you don't like it, stop. And I said, that's not what I mean. It's so difficult to watch something that is true, that happened in our lifetimes, that is such a travesty. It's terrifying. I mean, it's more scary than I think most horror films. And I wonder if you have other people react with that way, that to see this happen is so upsetting, it's almost unwatchable.
I've had people say that to me. I don't understand it. I can't say I don't agree with it because people should do what they're comfortable with. I think it's a little, I don't know, it's a little dramatic to me. You know what I mean? I look at the drama. I look at the pain that they endured. I look at us sitting on our couches and in our comfortable spaces and bearing witness to the trauma of another human being, and to be able to say, I see that, and I will allow myself to experience this so that I can grow in empathy and appreciation, not only for what I have, but to take stock of my own privilege and my own freedom. I think there are some, you know, positive benefits to watching things that may make us uncomfortable. And but I have had people that haven't pushed through like you did, that have said, ah, too painful, can't do it. That's what I don't understand. I think that's a drama. I think that's dramatic. I think that's...
Oh, I didn't stop watching.
I know. That's what I'm saying. Like, people who don't push through, I appreciate folks saying, ooh, this is rough. But, you know, I value folks who really have continued to watch and get to the end and really understand the gains by sitting in an uncomfortable space, by interrogating your own freedoms, your own opinions about boys of color, your own thoughts about the case, about the criminal justice system. Those are the conversations I love to have with people. But I liken it to this film, Turin Horse. It's very long. And for the first, like, hour, it's a man in, like, I don't know, an Eastern European hillside trying to hitch his horse and, like, go home. And he finally gets home, and then you see him make a fire. And then you see him put on his clothes, and he eats his soup, and he goes to bed, and he gets up and does it over again, like, 90 times. And I'm like, what am I watching? This is uncomfortable. I don't like this. But then you get to the end, and if you trust the filmmaker, which I hope people will watch when they see us, and trust me, when you get to the end, something that might be uncomfortable or even monotonous has all kinds of jewels and diamonds in there. So I just ask people to stick with it, like John did. He stuck with it. How did you feel at the end, John?
I mean, I mean, it is such a horrific miscarriage of justice that I was furious.
Good. That's
and angry at the outcome, and that these boys' lives were... I mean, I don't know what the right word is, because they're survivors.
Yes.
They're not victims, but
yes,
they're survivors.
Yes.
But that they were, their lives were irreparably changed.
Yes.
And hurt. And that there were people who took advantage of that. And certainly in the second episode of the series, you have dialogue from a certain real estate developer in New York who essentially called for the death penalty in full page newspaper ads in all the New York city papers for these boys.
Right.
And that, of course, is Donald Trump.
Yes.
When you were looking into the story, did you think you knew the story? And what surprised you about what you didn't know?
It was the families, you know? It was the family stories. Everything in there having to do with the families is real. As is, you know, I mean, the whole thing is just very true and based on what they told me. But gosh, you know, you think about a boy like Antoine McRae going to jail, juvenile detention prison eventually, and you think of his father telling him, just do what they say and sign the paper. And you have no idea what the impact of that is on the family, that it broke apart this family, fractured this family. They were never the same. It was those, you know, moments of, you know, Sharon Salam not even be able to call her son because she couldn't afford the prison phone rates that are exorbitant. And so you have fracture of families there. These are just things that I didn't think of as I'm looking at statistics. I make 13th. It's full of statistics, but it doesn't have the human story. So that's why I feel like this film was a continuation of some of the work in Selma and 13th. I want to give people the shape of the criminal justice system in 13th, but this is really the beating heart of what happens to all of those numbers of people, those millions of people behind bars, and their families.
Coming up on The Frame, more of my conversation with writer, director, and producer Ava DuVernay. She tells me how she's working to make the independent film community look more like the rest of the world. Now, more of my conversation with filmmaker Ava DuVernay. We met at the headquarters of her film collective called Array. It's near downtown LA in the historic Filipino Town neighborhood. Her four-part Netflix series on New York's Central Park 5 case, called When They See Us, is up for 16 Emmys. She told me what's behind the title.
For me, it was really about a title that had some meat on the bone, was about more than just Central Park 5. That was the working title for a long time. I felt that it was, you know, I became allergic to it. It had no meaning. It had no emotion to it. It felt really just like a moniker that had been given to these men by a lazy press corps at the time, by, you know, political entities and the police. They were grouped together. It dehumanized them. So as I knew it, that wasn't the title, and I was looking for something that really spoke to what I'm trying to do, which is talk about, and inherent in the title is a them and an us, right? And who is the they and who is the us? And that's really the way that so many people of color feel, particularly Black people, particularly Black men, that no one is walking in their shoes in this country. No one quite understands, you know, the scourge of being a Black man in any space in this country, a Black woman in these spaces. So it is really kind of calling attention to the divide. And then, you know, the behavior that's put on the divide, you know, a shaping that's always done, a review, an analysis of us based on how we look and not on who we are. And so all of that, a lot of what I've studied about Dr. King is also embedded in that title, that, you know, when I look at you walking down the street, John Horn is a very attractive man. He's a debonair kind of guy. But you, I would look, I see you and assume, oh, upstanding gentleman and law-abiding citizen. You look like that type. You could be anything, but you, the way you look has come to mean safe and okay, right? And the way that I look and my friends and some of my friends that I was with last night would mean just the opposite for someone if you're looking up in the dictionary.
What do you say to artists who keep hitting doors that are closed in ways that you and your company are supporting emerging artists? What are the initiatives that you are most excited about that can help those people get a chance to share their stories?
You know, I appreciate a lot of the film organizations around the country that have done really great work in supporting artists like Sundance and Tribeca and Film Independent. You know, for me, I'm thinking more systemically, you know, as opposed to artist labs and helping the young screenwriter with the writing and director's labs and teaching folks how to write a camera. What we do here at Array is we attack and disrupt systems. You know, we exhibit our own work. We book with alternative and rogue distributors around the country. We so distribution, exhibition. We also have created our own space for production. We don't have to go to any studio lot. We don't have to ask permission for anyone to edit, to have a writer's room, to prep, to shoot. And so it's kind of taking back all of these pieces of the puzzle that are doled out with permission, and really undermine the whole idea of independent filmmaking, because you're not really independent because you can't do any of it unless someone said it was okay. And so we are trying to be a little bit more radical in our thinking about independence.
Last question. What gets you fired up? What do you look forward to every morning?
Every day I have is different, and it's all filled with things that I love to do. And that's the way that I wanted to be when I grew up. And now I'm grown up, and that's the way it is. And I think that that's pretty remarkable. If I want to write, I can write. If I'm directing, then I'm doing what that means. If I'm producing, I'm working on a whole bunch of different projects. I'm moving from film to TV. I'm surrounded by people who I like and want to work with. I get to choose who I work with. I get to choose where I work. It's a great time. It's so great that I get a kind of scared that, God, can it last? But I asked Oprah this. I said, you know, you've been living a great life for a long time. You make me less scared that it's possible to live, like, do your work and be happy in your work and your life for long periods of time. And she said, you just have to trust that's for what is for you will be for you. And right now, in this time, this is for you. If it's meant for it to last, it will. And if it's not, it won't. Can't change it, so might as well just enjoy the day. And that's what I'm doing. It's a good day.
Ava, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
That was, of course, filmmaker Ava DuVernay, and that's it for this week. The Frame is produced by Oscar Garza, Darby Maloney, Jonathan Shiflett, Julia Paskin, and Robert Garova. Our news clerk is Andrea Gutierrez, and our intern is Paul Ratliff. Valentino Rivera is the show's engineer, and our opening theme music is by Taylor McFerrin. I'm John Horn. Make sure to tune in to The Frame Weekend, which airs Saturdays at 2 p.m., and like our daily show, it's part of our podcast feed. We're back here on Monday at the Moen Broadcast Center. Have a great weekend.